Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on multiple systems, on delivering your product or service, the more margin you have and the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, HR into one platform with one source of truth. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required, accessed from anywhere. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified business management suite. And you're improving efficiency by bringing all your major business processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move. So do the math. See how you'll profit with NetSuite.
Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/stereo. netsuite.com/stereo.
When it comes to weight loss, no two people are the same. That's why Noom builds personalized plans based on your unique psychology and biology. Take Brittany. After years of unsustainable diets, Noom helped her lose 20 pounds and keep it off.
I was definitely in a yo-yo cycle for years of just losing weight, gaining weight, and it was exhausting.
And Stephanie. She's a former D1 athlete who knew she couldn't out-train her diet, and she lost 38 pounds.
My relationship to food before Noom was never consistent.
And Evan, he can't stand salads, but he still lost 50 pounds with Noom.
I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. Even through the pickiness, Noom taught me that building better habits builds a healthier lifestyle. I'm not doing this to get to a number. I'm doing this to feel better.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom users compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Okay, here we go. Stand by. 3, 2, 1, action.
Assume nothing.
Rash, bald-faced blasphemy.
Question everything.
I find it extremely hard to imagine.
Open your eyes.
It is quite all right to be an atheist.
The fastest growing group of people in the country has been measured as being those who have no belief or who are atheists.
You don't have to be apologetic or quiet about it.
Challenge the opposition.
You see religion on 100 fronts losing the argument.
And start thinking. This is The Thinking Atheist Worldwide.
Before I get underway with today's show, a conversation with friend and fellow activist Matt Dillahunty, and there is a YouTube link in the description box if you want to watch the video, because we actually rolled cameras on this discussion. That link's in the description box. Before we kick that off, I have two very important announcements for you. The first is, starting on the 1st of January of 2019, the audio podcasts, the podcasts that do not include a video feed, will no longer upload to YouTube. Okay? Only video exchanges, video conversations, video interviews, video podcasts only will upload to YouTube, not the audio-only shows. The second announcement is this. We've moved to a new platform. Blog Talk Radio recently merged with Spreaker. That's Spreaker, Spreaker.com, which opens up a world of opportunities for us. It really is. The first benefit being that I was able to update and remove that clumsy old interface on the podcast page at thethinkingatheist.com. Now, the podcast interface online on the website is so much better. It's much more attractive, much more easy to use. It also means that the Thinking Atheist broadcast will be, if it's not already, available on Spotify, and the show's been submitted to iHeartRadio, one of the biggest online broadcast networks on the planet. So this is a good thing. It's an exciting thing. But if for any reason the show is not updating in your podcast app or player, you may want to unsubscribe and then resubscribe, making sure that you are using the RSS feed from Spreaker. Blog Talk Radio says that it really shouldn't require anything on your end, but just in case, I want to make sure that you don't miss out on content because the show just stopped updating, okay? So it's an exciting move as we get ready for the new year, and I'm excited about what doors this is going to open for us as we introduce these conversations, potentially, to a whole new audience. Anyway, those are the announcements. And this is A Skeptical Christmas. Again, Merry Christmas to you and yours, and I hope you enjoy the show.
Matt Dillahunty is a buddy of mine, and he's a guest at my home. We just thought it'd be cool to sit down for a few minutes and talk about. I guess we'll start with Christmas. Merry Christmas, right?
Merry Christmas. Merry Christmas, Seth.
Like, there are some purists out there, some atheists who are like, why in the world would you acknowledge the holiday when we all know that Christmas was, the Jesus-driven Christmas was stolen from the pagans, and they jump on that soapbox and lose their minds. And I just don't get lost in all that stuff. What's your take on it?
I'll say whatever, and I'm happy to have almost anything said to me. Beth and I did an atheist Christmas video a year or two ago talking about this. And this year it's actually been a little strange as well because the conversation is never going to stop. But I have friends, particularly some who are ex-Muslims or who weren't raised in other cultures, and some of them feel that Merry Christmas is like a passive-aggressive thing. I could see that if somebody was walking up to you going, Happy Jesus' birthday. But that's not what's actually happening. Christmas is largely secular. It's predominantly secular. And, you know, I kind of half-joked that if you took a poll in July, stood outside of a church, and got people as they walked out of church and said, hey, what are the first three things you think of when I say this? And start with a couple innocuous things and then say Christmas. I would be surprised if Jesus made the top three. Even walking out of church in July, if you said, what are the three things you think of when I say Thanksgiving, when I say peanut butter, and then you say, when I say Christmas, because you're going to get like Frosty and Santa and presents and family and trees. Yeah. And yeah, so it's all secular. I generally look at it as, I know that most people, like I was raised, there are two Christmases. There's Christ's birthday that we all celebrate as Christians, and then there's the secular Christmas. And they were always distinct in my mind. And so when somebody says Merry Christmas, I just look at that as kind of, I want to say something nice. I want to be pleasant. I know there's a holiday season. I don't know what else to say. This is just what I say. It's not like telling somebody happy birthday when it's not their birthday. It's just, you know.
The Christmas pageants were always a kick, or my favorite, join us or drive by Church X on these dates through these dates for our live nativity featuring live animals. That always blew my mind. Like, we got a camel. And we want you to pack the van. We want you to drive through. And I guess that the highlight is, oh, look, a camel, you know, and then there's Mary and Joseph and the baby and all that. I understand why people might resist that, the commercialization. I mean, I get the cynicism, but I mean, isn't it what you make it, like anything else, right?
So I like the camel thing is extra amusing to me. I have a buddy of mine who has a, used to be a private zoo in North Georgia, but he's opened it to the public a few years ago. He's got some great animals, but he does stuff like that. It's like, hey, I've got a camel, and over the holidays, I rent it out to, you know, churches to do their Christmas pageants and everything else.
Like the camel sitting there going, this is just a bunch of crap. I mean, come on.
I really wish that like in the traditional Easter story, there were like wolves and stuff, because he's got wolves. I'd love him to see, so here's Jesus and there's a camel and then there's two wolves. And I'd be like, well, what's going on here?
They're licking their chops, you know, they're salivating at the,
oh,
yummy. I'm interested in the stuff, we talk about this on the radio quite a bit, some of the stuff that many people get hung up on. I'm going to get crucified for this, but I think it's ridiculous to sit around all day and stamp out In God We Trust on the money. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but the people who'd sit there with a Sharpie all day, and that is their form of protest, or they've got the stamp that says E Pluribus Unum, because I don't think that's how you solve the problem. Or when somebody says, bless you, and after you sneeze and you stop and you're like, blessings, I don't believe in blessings, that's magical thinking. And you immediately take a gesture of kindness and you turn it into a sort of an asshole moment. I mean, is this really what how we're going to win the battle? I'm watching your expression. I'm waiting to get crucified by Dillahunty.
No, but I'm kind of a couple different minds, because part of me completely agrees. Part of me thinks that there's maybe a slight bit of exaggeration there, because if somebody were, in fact, sitting around all day doing nothing but stamping,
you know what I mean.
I know. You exaggerate for clarity. I don't have a problem with somebody doing that, because that may be the little thing that raises awareness that changes how people see this. It's not going to change whether or not "In God We Trust" is the motto. It's not going to change whether or not that motto appears on the money right away on its own. But it may make people aware. Like, most people don't know that that didn't happen until the 1950s, that we changed a perfectly good motto to "In God We Trust." And it may, I don't know how effective it is. I don't know how much of a teaching moment it is. I don't know what people are getting out of it. But if somebody feels better, when I get a dollar bill that's got God crossed out or
hasn't. You're an atheist activist. Of course, it's going to ring your bell. I get that. But I mean, do you think the advocates for "In God We Trust" are going to do anything but, you know, they're just going to blink at it
But that's the thing. There are no advocates for "In God We Trust." The truth is that became the motto in the 50s, and nobody's cared or thought about it much since on that side of it.
It's challenged, though.
Yeah, but we haven't really. So here's the thing. Michael Newdow has been suing over "In God We Trust" for years, and I have always, always said that I think it's an absolutely terrible idea for him to do that, because this is something that you cannot win given the current state of affairs. There's no way he's ever going to get "In God We Trust" removed from the money just by going through these court proceedings. And there are those that would argue that those court proceedings are necessary to gradually change, like, the zeitgeist so that people have a better understanding about religious liberty. My concern with the actual lawsuits is that you may end up setting a very bad precedent. Because if you're in a position where you can't win and you lose, that loss counts as precedent, which hinders the chance for progress later. And so I disagree with that particular lawsuit, because I also think there are bigger issues to worry about when we have people's civil rights being violated and stuff like that. But I can also appreciate that as long as we don't set a bad precedent, what we're doing is generally raising awareness. And I don't sit around and mark out "And God We Trust."
You're not the guy who goes into the Marriott and marks up the Book of Mormon.
No, but I have hidden them. Jeff D. had suggested on an episode of The Nonprofits that people play hide the Bible. And so if I go into a hotel room, and I'm thinking about it, I don't do this every time, all the time, but if I find a Bible, it's usually there's a Gideon Bible in the nightstand or whatever, we hide it. And there were people that would actually email nonprofits and say, you know, we went into the hotel room and we were looking for the Bible and we couldn't find it, and we found where somebody hid it.
Oh, really?
And
you're not defacing property. It's clever. It's kind of funny. I mean, I get that.
Well, and technically, the Gideons leave them there for you. And you could, any Bible that you find in a hotel that's placed by the Gideons, it's perfectly acceptable to actually just take it. They will come around and replace it. This is their way of getting Bibles into people's hands.
This is like a long version of Chick Tracks that they just leave for people. Has anyone ever in a hotel room actually ever read the Bible? I always say the Book of Mormon, because Marriott properties are owned by a Mormon, and he includes the book, which was a surprise to me, right? We were staying in a Marriott property, and I was like, the Book of Mormon? You know, you gotta be shitting me. But it was totally legit, and I guess they do it all over the country. So.
I like the fact that typically they're not sitting out.
They're in drawers.
They're usually in a nightstand.
Yeah.
And for me, when I first kind of encountered this, it was, okay, if you're in a hotel room and you, let's say, want to put on a pay-per-view adult video thing because you're on the road and this is what you want to watch, I always wonder how many people would, if they like saw the Bible sitting next to the TV, would still order their porno pay-per-view.
Did you see that? I think Daryl Ray at Secular Sexuality was talking about how that porn use in Utah is among the highest in the nation. So you've got this sexually repressed culture of people with their collars buttoned all the way to the top, and they're trying their best to be morally pure. But the truth is when the lights are off or when the doors are locked or nobody's looking, they're using porn more than the average American. I find it very telling. So,
and I was very happy to see that there is actually Mormon porn. And by that, I don't mean that there were actually Mormons doing porn. I mean there are porn companies that are producing porn that kind of mocks Mormonism. So you've got the young girl in the Mormon underwear, the magical Mormon underwear.
Oh, yeah.
And they'll do like church service things or special baptisms. So now everybody knows my porn viewing habits and how weird this. It's one of those things that you just find and you're like,
Holy crap, how does this exist?
I'm here to fix your soul. I'm an expert. Right, is that the deal? They come knock on the door, and she's like, oh, I'm so glad you came. Let's talk about, I mean, is that that kind of thing?
I've seen the Catholic ones where it's like, forgive me, Father, where I've sinned, and in, sex becomes part of the penance. I've seen the Mormon ones where they're doing some kind of Mormon ceremony. Anyway, Seth asked me to come over and hang out and talk a little bit about Christmas. And it immediately, it's... Alice Jennifer's going to sue us.
Whenever we sit down and talk, whether it's over sushi or just sitting on the couch or just hanging out or whatever, it's just funny because the conversation just, you never know where it's going to drift. I first met Matt back in 2011, first time. Now, I knew of your work before, but I had first stepped out of the atheist closet in 2011. I'd actually hosted the Thinking Atheist anonymously or semi-anonymously because I was still extricating myself from a religious life, for lack of a better way of saying it.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I figure once I show my face and give my last name, cat's out of the bag. Will they find an excuse to fire me? Will my life change? Will my family shun me? I was just freaked out. And so it was the summer of 2011 at an Oklahoma Freethought event, and Matt was there, and Aaron, and some other great speakers, I'm not kissing your ass. I've just been a fan ever since. You were born to do this. You were really good at these conversations, counter apologetics, debates. I don't know. Do I include philosophy in that? Since philosophy obviously has been deemed unnecessary by science.
There are plenty of people some people will view me an expert in a number of areas. Most would view me as a dilettante in most of those areas.
All right. So wait. Back to philosophy though. If I'm that guy and says science answers all questions, philosophy is just essentially some sort of a form of mental masturbation.
That's a fundamental misunderstanding of philosophy.
Now, what is how would I define philosophy?
Let's see, now that's the sticky thing. Because there's a lot of bad philosophy, and there is a lot of this, like, not quite contemplative navel-gazing stuff, but... like Aaron will just knock philosophy and say, oh, they're just sitting around making up words and engaging in stuff that's completely useless. There's different areas and branches within philosophy. And for me, the most important one is epistemology. This is the foundation of skepticism. This is how we know that we can reason at all and how reliable reasoning is. Without that area within philosophy, you wouldn't have logic. You wouldn't have essentially some of the core of mathematics. You wouldn't have science at all. And so you get this notion of how falsifiability, all these concepts within science that allow us to get incredibly reliable results. But philosophy is the structure, in some regards, that allows you to be confident that you're going to get good results, that you can rely on reason. Other areas of philosophy, you know, where... you know, can God make a burrito so hot that even he can't eat it? That's a different thing, and I will mock it along with everybody else. And I also think there's a lot of philosophy that's done bad. I understand why most people aren't interested, because even the areas of philosophy where we get incredible benefits, where we have a good understanding of epistemology, is the study of how do you know what you know? How do you know that you can reasonably reason? How do you know that reason is going to produce any reliable results? Those branches are important.
Take 50 theologians, put them in a room, and get them to agree on the basics, on whatever. Pick a religion, I'll obviously go to Christianity, but get them to talk about, you know, hell, the nature of hell, the properties of hell. Get them to talk about baptism, eternal salvation, those types of things. And you'll just see them chew each other's eyeballs up, right? Which I consider to be something that discredits, I mean, you know, God's perfect word from the God who's not the author of confusion. Sure. The fact that he has confused everybody monumentally is one of the great refutations of the goodness, if nothing else, the goodness of God.
Yeah, I've made the case before that, you know, if the Bible says that God is not the author of confusion, then God's not the author of the Bible. And then if God's not the author of the Bible, then you had no reason to believe that God was not the author of confusion in the first place. So you end up in this really vicious circle over there.
See, that's philosophy.
Philosophy, yeah. Well, where I'm going with that is, so let's say I take 50 philosophers and stick them in a room and they're all waxing on about, you know, these deep existential type questions. I don't necessarily unless they're being dogmatic, I don't necessarily see that as the same kind of negative, because is this a genuine and honest pursuit of the truth in its purest form?
There's a great distinction between the two, and that is that theologians are talking about the specifics of something that is not demonstrably real, and philosophers are talking about the specifics of something that is demonstrably real, the nature of existence. We at least begin with this notion, if two philosophers sit down, most of the time, well, at least they begin with, we're going to talk about this, and we agree that this is a thing, even if we don't fully understand it. Whereas theologians are talking about something that we can't even identify as a thing, God, the supernatural. You know, if we have no way to investigate something, which is the case for the supernatural, the only thing we can investigate is the natural world, as far as we know. And so if the supernatural doesn't manifest in a detectable way, that means God, ghosts, whatever, then what's actually happening is the believers are claiming to detect the undetectable. I have found the unfindable. I have experienced that which cannot be experienced. This doesn't manifest in reality in any way, and despite the fact that I'm completely bound in reality, I have experienced it. That's what's going on with theology, and that's what's going on with religions and people who are advocating for the supernatural. Philosophers are just digging into the areas where we don't have good explanations for the universe, and we don't necessarily have good methods to investigate them in like a scientific fashion. How do you do a test for, I don't know, morality?
So if somebody's spinning a kind of, I call it philosophical word salad, like Jordan Peterson. I mean, some would consider him one of the great philosophers of our time. People keep telling me this.
I've never met anybody who actually thinks he's a great philosopher.
No?
He's a psychologist. I know some of his fans might go down that route.
Yeah, I'm talking about the fan base. And normally what happens is they'll say, what do you think about Jordan Peterson? And I'm like, well, the minute he gets into the metaphysical substrate and just spins himself off into oblivion, I'm just like, this guy is not, he's not the source that we need to be speaking to. And they always, almost always say, but have you read his book, or have you read his other book, or did you see this other speech, or did you? And I'm like, we're not talking about his other book right now. We're talking about this specific question and his specific response on the record to that question. And there's deflection everywhere I look. I find him hugely frustrating.
I keep asking fans, because they're constantly coming after me and being critical, because Jordan and I did an event in Toronto. I enjoyed it. I thought it went pretty well. I did not find any of his answers particularly impressive or enlightening.
He said you can't be an atheist because you're just too good a guy. I mean,
he said none of us are atheists. Yeah. Because a real atheist would be a murderer.
And you actually said, I think, forgive me for jumping in, but you said essentially, you sound like Ray Comfort. I mean, it's kind of what you told him. You sound like freaking Ray Comfort. I don't know if he knows Ray Comfort, but it was a very Ray Comfort kind of answer.
I tell you what, some of the fans will come up and say, well, have you read his books? No, I haven't. I still haven't. Hugo and Jake, though, from Bible Reloaded, are reading 12 Rules to Life and going chapter by chapter through it. I highly recommend, if you're interested in that, watch it. I think it's like an hour and a half video they're doing per chapter, where they're reading it, discussing it, pointing out what they agree with and what they don't, and all the things that Jordan apparently doesn't understand. But my problem with him is at a core level. There's no denying the guy is popular, that he's a popular speaker, that he is reaching people on some level. But when I ask fans, tell me something specific that Jordan has said that you find impressive or meaningful, I get nothing. It's all this abstract, fuzzy stuff. My big problem with him is that he willingly denies or rejects any useful notion of truth. And as soon as you do that, all discussion has to end. Because if your thing, his view of truth is, it's true if it's useful. It's true if it's beneficial to reality.
By whose measuring stick?
Exactly. Sam Harris took him to task on this a little bit, saying, you know, it's your wife. If your wife is cheating on you, that's either true or not true, irrespective of whether or not it benefits reality or you or anything else. You know, and I had looked at it. You know, it's true or not true that I'm currently dying of cancer, whether or not that benefits me or not. And so this whole spin on it with his metaphorical substrate and constantly looking for broader meaning in narratives. There's nothing wrong with that until you're also in the position where you're denying truth. And so he's running around with his 12 rules of life saying, tell the truth or at least don't lie, when in fact he's been busted not telling the truth and lying in the very book, probably in the very chapter that he's talking about this. And it's a strange thing to watch, but I don't know if he and I'll ever do another event, and I didn't come here to
I have nothing against him. I mean, I'd be happy to have dinner with a guy, and
you know, would be eating, well, he would be eating only meat.
Like a keto kind of thing, or?
Oh, it's a special diet. Oh wow. literally eats nothing but meat. No veggies, no nothing.
Can
just
you
meat.
Do that? Well, I mean, can you survive only on?
We're going to find out, because it's like his daughter's thing, and he's doing it too, and I think maybe his wife. But the doctors have come out and said, this is a really bad idea. Wow. You should not be doing this. And I guess we'll find out.
He'd fit in great in Oklahoma. You know, this is the state where everybody pretty much shoots their own food. Yeah. So, you know, he'd fit right in.
Quick break. When I come back, I'm going to talk to Matt about reality. Like, how do we know what's real? How do we determine what's true? How do we know we're not all just living in a massive simulation? We've been plugged into the Matrix, and this reality isn't reality at all. We're going to get deep. We'll talk about this stuff right after this. Hang on. As we move into the new year, I hope that you will consider becoming a supporter on Patreon. My amazing patrons get a couple of key benefits. Mostly they just support because they want to, but they get the show usually 2 days before it releases to the general public, and the version of the show that they download via Patreon is totally 100% commercial free. So if you would like to support me, to support this broadcast, if it brings benefit to your life, I can't tell you how much your support means, how important it is. You can just go to patreon.com/SethAndrews, and then you just determine how much you want to support, how many shows, how often, what spending cap you might want to put in place. It's all totally up to you. You control everything. patreon.com/SethAndrews.
Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on multiple systems, on delivering your product or service, the more margin you have and the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, HR into one platform with one source of truth. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required, accessed from anywhere. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified business management suite. And you're improving efficiency by bringing all your major business processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move. So do the math. See how you'll profit with NetSuite.
Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/stereo. netsuite.com/stereo.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Let's talk about truth. I hate to, I mean, I don't want to get too thick, but
if someone comes to us. Are you asking to talk about philosophy now?
I want to talk about truth. I'm going to step out of the metaphysical substrate.
Okay.
And when someone says, how do you know what you know? In other words, if you participate in a process of experimentation to see if 1 + 1 = 2, how do you know that you are conducting the experiment in a reality where those results are reliable? And it's this weird question about, you know, I guess it's a spin on how do you know you're not a brain in a vat? How do you know that your entire reality is not a construct of your brain, blah, blah, blah. And so I think at its core, a legitimate question. How do I know whenever someone shows me the fossil record or DNA evidence for evolution or those types of things, how do I know that the scientific method that's being used is rooted in an actual reality?
You don't. You don't.
Well, shit.
It's incredibly frustrating. The thing is, we're all in that same boat. So there are a couple notions about truth that have puzzled people. One of them is that that truth requires absolute certainty. Now, I'm not convinced that you can get to absolute certainty about anything. I used to argue that you could about some things, and then it was rightly pointed out to me that all of those things that I said you could be absolutely certain about, that's contingent on having absolute certainty that reason is reasonable. Now, I know I just lost you and 20 other people for a second. But basically, reasoning, this process, we construct an argument, we know that true premises lead to a true conclusion. We know that. That's reasoning. But how do you know that that's the case or that it's always the case? It ties into the how do you know that the reality you experience is actually the really real one? I'm here to make most of you comfortable in that you can't and you shouldn't worry about it because everybody's in the same boat. And what happens is in the theology realms, they reach to an external God hypothesis to give them the confidence and certainty. There is the rock solid foundation upon which everything else is based. For the rest of us, recognizing that they have no way of proving their rock solid foundation is in fact solid, the best thing we can do is say, look, I experience whatever reality I experience. I'm convinced that Seth and I are in the same reality. I don't think he's a figment of my imagination. I don't think he's another construct in the story. I can't prove it. But until somebody shows me that that base assumption is not the case, I'm forced to operate under those assumptions. If I step out in front of a bus, it doesn't do me any good to go, well, I don't know for sure there's a bus. I don't know that this is the really real reality. I have to, as a matter of practicality, do that. And when you get comfortable with a couple of things, one, acknowledging I don't know, and number two, that I am not certain, the rest of it goes away because now everything is relatively reliable. If you have a yardstick, it's 36 inches. We made up what an inch is. We made up what a foot is. This is not some, and this is completely arbitrary. But if I'm woodworking in the garage, I can use a ruler to measure to make sure that I'm getting the same measurement across. And it doesn't matter if that's some absolute standard or not. But I don't even need that. I don't need a ruler. If I want to build a chair to go over in that corner, I don't need to know what the exact measurement of the height is. I just raise it to whatever height I want and then build everything else relative to it. You don't ever have to measure. You can just mark everything relative. And yet somehow, with no discrete measurement, we can still get an incredibly beautiful piece of furniture, a comfortable chair. And we would all agree, yep, that's a chair.
But I mean, that's problematic, right? If I'm in a conversation with an apologist and I admit, I can't be sure that this is reality. I just go with what I know. In his mind, he's trumped me.
Yeah, I think, and I hit this mostly in the Psy debate.
Psy Tim Brueggen.
Psy Tim Brueggen. So here's the thing. I came up, because I don't think you can be absolutely certain about anything, I used a different phrase for that debate, which was maximal certainty, which may be equal to absolute certainty. It's just that there's no way to demonstrate that. But when the theist comes and says, well, you can't be absolutely certain, my response is, I agree, and I don't see that you can be absolutely certain either. And the only answer they can give to how they're absolutely certain is that somehow God makes it possible. They can't tell you how. They can't show any way of confirming it. There's no way to distinguish between Psy telling me that God makes him absolutely certain and somebody else simply, whether or not that's true or whether Psy is just convinced that God makes him absolutely certain. You know, there's no way out of this problem. There's no solution to the problem of hard solipsism. There's different definitions of truth. I tend to use truth is that which is compatible with reality or that which occurs in reality. And then they're like, well, how do you know that's reality? I'm talking about the reality I experience. Even if I'm living in the Matrix,
it's still the reality you experience.
It's whatever this reality I experience. And I have no way out of the Matrix until somebody shows me a way out. And then I can go, wow, that reality wasn't real. But until then, I still got to watch out for the buses when I'm crossing the street. And I don't have to be, I realize that people are frustrated by this notion of relativity, of if I begin with, I'm going to assume this is the reality I experience, as long as everything's internally consistent within there, as long as things don't break their rules, you know, if you dematerialized and walked through the wall, that would fundamentally change everything I know and understand about reality. That doesn't happen. And it's one of those things when you're engaged with theists and you know, it will go back to Christmas time, and you have the virgin birth miracle. That is a strong tenet in almost every variety of Christianity. And the cool thing for me is, we know that virgin births are possible in other species. Parthenogenesis, the ability for a creature to reproduce without sex, even if they're normally sexually reproducing. I think some sharks have done it and some others. And there are also species in the ocean, for example, that completely change their gender, change their sex through some process. But that doesn't happen in humans. We have no evidence of happening in humans. But let's say we found a human that reproduced without sex, and we could absolutely confirm this. Well, that's still a process that has nothing to do with whether or not there was divine intervention. At the end of the day, even demonstrating something that appears to us miraculous does not tell you how it occurred. So let's say there's a true story that Mary conceived a child without ever having sex. I'm not convinced any part of this story is remotely true, whether or not she existed or had a kid or whatever, but we'll go with that. That does not lead us to the inevitable conclusion that therefore God magically impregnated this. And that whole explanation is something we see over and over again. Whenever we don't understand something, someone will stick a God in there. And, oh, we don't understand how somebody could be pregnant never having had sex. It must be a miracle.
Or a lie.
yeah, I get it. Have you seen that meme where it shows Mary and she's got the pregnancy test and she's like, shit, you know.
Gotta make something up.
Yeah.
Quick.
Do you think mockery in that way has utility out there? You know, some people are like, why must you mock religions? I find in my own activism that, not on the one-on-ones, but I mean, in the larger spectrum, the bigger picture, I think it's healthy for these sacred cows to be sort of roasted over the open flame, right?
Yeah, I've always said that mockery is one of many tools. Ridicule goes along with it. And I've said frequently that ridiculous ideas are deserving of ridicule by definition, but people aren't. And the problem is that even if you're very careful making sure that what I'm ridiculing is an idea and not the person who believes that idea, there's still people who are going to take offense.
They're going to borrow the offense and decide that you've attacked them personally.
Yeah.
Though.
And my favorite is, you know, okay, if somebody's offended because I ridiculed the God concept that they believe in, I can still have a conversation with them about that. I can say, you know, okay, I wasn't intending to offend you. I find the idea ridiculous, and I pointed out why. But if you're offended on behalf of your God, what is it you think of your God? How weak is your God that he needs you to be offended and try to defend him on his, you know, why can't God come and tell me that he's offended, that I have objections to this ridiculous process? Now, on the show, on the Atheist Experience show, I never start with ridicule, or I try to never start with ridicule, because there's a conversation there, and I want to figure out where this person is, because the whole process is, I'm not necessarily going after the person on the phone to change their mind. I'm open to having my mind changed. It's about the audience watching who shares those beliefs. And I feel that there's a benefit to some degree of ridicule, because the person who's at home, not on the phone, who has those beliefs, feels the anxiety of seeing the person who agrees with them kind of having their ideas roasted. So they get this discomfort, but they don't have the protective mechanism of actually being on the phone at the time. The person who's on the phone at the time is more than likely going to double down or ignore or tune out anything to maintain that.
Yeah, the spectator's still in a relatively safe space.
Yeah, right? And that gives them the safety to say, hang on, I believe what that guy believes, and for pretty much the same reasons, and they just had all their reasons exposed as flawed. Now, my hope is that when that happens, some of them are going to go out and say, I need better reasons. I need a better understanding of this. I need to understand, let me go out and show why that atheist guy on the TV show is wrong. I know people do this because they will email me.
And you did it.
Yeah. But there are people who will email and say, you know, I used to think you were an asshole. I called into the show. Yeah, it's true. I called into the show and used to argue with you. And then I stopped calling, but I kept listening. And then I took notes. And my whole goal was to show how you were wrong. And now I'm an atheist. And I'm like, cool. I appreciate that more than something that happened at a debate I did in Dallas, where a guy came up to me and said, hey, I walked in here as a sincere, believing, fundamentalist Christian, and I'm leaving as an atheist, so thanks. And I stopped him. I was in, you know, I had to pack up equipment, so we didn't get to talk much. I wanted to talk to that guy more than almost anybody.
Is that a play on sort of an authority thing? Like,
I'm terrified that this guy had bad reasons when he walked in and left with bad reasons, too. Because I would be very surprised that somebody would sit down and over the course of a 2 or 2.5 hour discussion between two people, fundamentally change their mind.
Taking your word for it only without doing his own homework.
Yeah, it seemed. Now, what was the case with this guy is that he'd been doing some studying, and you know, I was kind of more of the straw that broke the camel's back than, or what I said was the straw. I wasn't a straw. I'm irrelevant.
No, I mean, I think that it happened to me. I was watching a debate video, Christopher Hitchens, right? A guy I was predisposed to have a disagreement with, but I was interested in. And when the guy you disagree with makes sense, that's it's a weird place to be. But it's also, you know, it's terrifying, it's exciting, it's, you know, it lit the fire under me to kind of do my own digging, and lo and behold, I'm an atheist now. Go figure.
And there's nothing new about it, too. Actually, one of my favorite anecdotes comes from Benjamin Franklin. He was explaining how he came to be a deist. And I'm going to paraphrase the quote, but essentially it was, some books on deism came into my hands, and the books were intending to expose the problems with deism. And upon reading those books, I found the arguments for deism more compelling than the arguments against deism. And so, you know, deism being, I think Dawkins calls deism sexed up atheism, or maybe that's pantheism. But it's this notion of, you know, there's, we don't believe in a personal God. We believe in some God, some first order, whatever. And so it was basically theists writing to say, no, this deism stuff is not good. You can't go down this road with, you know, some non-personal, non-interventionist God. And Ben Franklin was evidently like, your arguments against this are so bad.
Yeah.
That I'm now a deist.
I want to come back to something in just a second. I'm going to put a mental placeholder here. But I'm sure you've heard and probably told the story of the Jefferson Bible, right? Mm. You know, my own father is a devout believer, grieved by his atheist son. And back before, you know, back when we had actual conversations, before I'd sort of drawn some boundaries, he was talking, I think, about the founding fathers. And, you know, we were founded on God and a Christian nation narrative that we see on Fox News every December, especially. And so I sent him a photograph of the Jefferson Bible, which is on display at the Smithsonian, I believe. And it's where Thomas Jefferson had taken an X-Acto knife and he had just removed all the supernatural elements of the Christian Bible and just kept the rest. Talk about a cafeteria kind of a religion.
Anybody who was watching just then saw my face go into a freeze mode because X-Acto knives didn't exist then.
You know what I mean.
I know what you meant.
He used an X-Acto quill. I don't know what he used, but he sliced them all out, okay?
Yeah. And all the supernatural references.
I sent my father, I'm like, by the way, Thomas Jefferson removed the supernatural from the equation, at least in regard to Christianity. And it was, you know, his response was, you know, a Christian nation, God is love. It was just a kind of a parroted thing that we often hear when people are confronted with refuting arguments. Let me come back to atheist, agnostic. I don't get too tripped up on labels, but labels can be useful, right? I mean, labels help to define what
we are. Everything is a label. You cannot communicate without labels.
So I see online, I was having a spirited discussion, usually with a wink online, with one of the hosts of Non Sequitur, I think.
Yes, you and I were both until I blocked him.
I actually had this identical conversation in Dallas yesterday,
you?
And they're trying to set up a thing where me and Steve are on the same show to talk about.
And I got nothing against it. It was good for him. But he is, I'm like, if you're agnostic, you're an atheist. And he's like, no, actually, that's not true. And I'm like, if you do not know, you do not believe, therefore you are an atheist. And there was, that thread went on for freaking days. In regard to agnosticism, too, I'll also hear that agnostics are atheists that are just too cowardly to admit it, which I think is a terrible thing to say.
I don't think that's accurate. That's awful.
But do you get into the atheist agnostic?
Nope. Well, I will on occasion. I did a video on this whole labeling issue where my ultimate conclusion was, I really don't care what you call yourself. I'm more concerned, and this is what irritated me about what Steve McRae did. If you tell other people they're using the label wrong, that's a problem because that's prescriptive. That is, words have intended prescriptive meanings or usages. And I think words have usages, not meaning, and I prefer a descriptive look at this and say, okay, you're using the word atheist in this context, somebody else is using it in this context, and if I'm going to have a conversation with the people in this group, I cannot say that they're using the label wrong because of this other group.
Well, to a degree, I mean, words in the common sense do have a definition that we rely on, right?
Well, they have the common usage, and the usage can change. When I say man, Seth, you are bad, that means good, not bad. That's the exact opposite of what the word meant. When you look at words like...
strong and...
faggot, what's that mean? Well, it used to mean a bundle of sticks, and it had other usages before then, but then it became a slur for homosexuals. Hmm. And in the UK, a fag is just a cigarette, because it comes from that bundle of sticks tradition. So we change... language is our thing to play with. And the only thing that matters is, if I'm having a conversation with somebody, are we using the words in the same way? And this is where the big mistake comes in, because quite honestly, I'm becoming more and more convinced that we're not. And I was supposed to do an event with Steven Pinker a week or so ago, but it got canceled. And this was one of the things that I hoped to talk to him about, because not only is he brilliant, but he's a linguist. Doing this stuff on language is important, because how do we learn? Like, how did you learn English? Yeah, we took English classes in school, but that's not how we learned English.
Yeah, surrounded by it.
You're smothered by people around you. And so that means we learned all the foundations entirely through inference and trying to understand context. Now, what if your family spoke English and had a particularly esoteric usage for a couple of terms? You know, your understanding of what those terms meant is going to be entirely based on what the family is. And if you run around telling everybody else that they're wrong right off the bat, you are just trying to impose this thing. If instead you say, wow, that's not what my understanding was, or I use it this way, or this entire group of people use it this way, hopefully you can move a conversation forward. At the end of the day, though, Steve McRae is pointing out a problem with the atheist label that is an actual problem.
What's the problem? We're back to the, I know there is no God.
You're labeling an there's an inequality between theism being a positive belief for something and atheism, they want it to be a positive disbelief in something.
I absolutely know there is no God.
Well, not even absolutely know. It's not, knowledge is a subset of belief. So theism is, I believe there's a God. And they want atheism to be, I believe there is no God. And most people are using it in a different sense, which is the direct negation of this. I do believe there is a God. I do not believe there is a God. And that makes it, there's no middle ground.
Well, I'll use the word, like, I know, I can say I know there is no benevolent God because there is no benevolence, divine benevolence, right? But I mean, I can say I don't believe in God in any sense because I haven't seen any reason to hold such a belief.
Yeah, I've actually started changing my language a little bit when I talk about this and say, for me, you believe something if you are convinced it's true, but people don't quite grasp that. So instead of even saying believe, sometimes I will just say a theist is someone who is convinced there is a God, and an atheist is someone who is not convinced that there's a God. And that's distinct from someone who is convinced there's not a God. And I make that distinction because as soon as you're convinced there's not a God, if you're trying to convince somebody else of that, you have a burden of proof. But there's no burden of proof for not being convinced of somebody's claim. If somebody says, hey, I can move things with my mind and I say I'm not convinced, it would be ridiculous for them to say, well, prove that I can't.
Do you get hung up on the word believe if someone comes up and says, I believe in evolution? Do you take their larger meaning that they accept the evidence for evolution? Or do you reject the word believe in that context?
I never reject the word believe. Not only do I accept it when somebody says, I believe evolution, I think that's the most accurate description. They are convinced that evolution is real, or they are convinced that a particular model of evolution is accurate. There are people who are terrified of this word believe.
Well, they're afraid it's an equivalent of faith language.
Yes, because they think if I say I believe something, what I really want is to say I know something. And knowledge is something, you know, grander than belief. But the truth is, knowledge is a subset of belief. Here's all the things that I believe, and some of them I also know. But we don't wait till we have knowledge to act. Knowledge doesn't require certainty. Knowledge is basically an expression of a confidence level. I believe that I really, really, really believe this is what it means when you say, I know this. It's a bit more than that, because what you're saying is, I believe this, I think there are good reasons, I believe it fairly strongly. But I have no problem with somebody saying I believe something, because we do. It's just a fact. We are convinced of all sorts of things, and we don't wait until we have knowledge to act. You don't sit around going, you know, I think this is probably the case, but I'm going to wait until I have knowledge. You just don't. And we're confused. And knowledge is harder to define than what belief is. Knowledge is, in philosophy, this is where the argument comes in.
What is knowledge?
Yeah.
How do you know it?
The one of the most common philosophical definitions is knowledge is justified true belief. Now, there's problems with that definition.
I'm trying to define each individual word.
Yes.
All right.
Justified true belief. And belief is I'm convinced of something and it happens to be true and I am justified in that it's true. Because if you have a $100 bill in your right front pocket right now and I believe that, I have a belief that Seth has a $100 bill in his pocket, it happens to be true. But what if I have no good reason for that? What if I'm just guessing? What if I'm just, you know... What if I've been misled by bad information? Like, for example, somebody told me you have a $100 bill in your wallet and they had no reason. So now I'm just taking it on authority. So does it count as knowledge then? And generally speaking, philosophers would say that doesn't count as knowledge. That knowledge is something where you have to have a rational justification for it. The problem is you can't get rid of the true part either, because a justified belief could still be false. And this is the part that tends to throw people.
Yeah.
Because I could have really good reasons to believe that my significant other is not having an affair. You know, I've witnessed their actions for ages. I have no evidence for it. There's not evidence where I would expect it. And yet I could be wrong because I have insufficient information. The better example is the notion that the sun went around the earth. At the time, that was a perfectly reasonable conclusion because it was what you could directly observe. That the sun moved across the sky. It turns out that's wrong. That's not what happens. The earth spins on its axis, and that's what makes the sun appear to go around the earth. And in fact, the earth goes around the sun, which was even more counterintuitive. But you could have a belief, and it could have been justified, and it turned out to not be true. And that's why they tend to define knowledge as justified true belief. There are other problems with that definition. The biggest one being, what is truth? Back to what we were discussing before. And how do you know that it's truth? Because it may be the case that we have no access to ultimate truth. And so the ultimate truth may be that there is no sun, there is no earth, I'm in a brain of that. And so all I can talk about is a relative truth. And now we're stuck with, well, you have to let it go through your senses. You know, how reliable are your senses? Your senses get fooled all the time. We have optical illusions, auditory hallucinations, all kinds. How do you know how reliable your senses are? And getting back to the question you asked, you know, 10, 15 minutes ago, and that is independent confirmation. I'll never be able to prove that Seth actually exists in the same reality that I do and that he's not a figment of my imagination. But if I ask him, hey, is that camera focused? And he says, yes, I've got independent confirmation. We can exploit that. And this is, while there's no solution to this problem of hard solipsism, there's something that I think comes close, which is if hard solipsism were true, if I am the only living thing and everything else is a figment of my imagination or being created by a matrix or the new evil demon or whatever else, then that means that I've written every great song and every crappy song. I've been every caller to the Atheist Experience, whether they were annoying or wonderful. I have managed to somehow teach myself things that I didn't know but must have known. At some point, I didn't understand white balance, ISO, and shutter speed. Mm-hmm. And yet, they'd been in use for years. And if I know that if I looked it up 10 years ago, I would have found the same information, and 20 years ago, I would have found the same information. And somebody taught me what those three things are. At that moment, they entered my understanding. But if hard solipsism were true, then in reality, they were always true, and I was just hiding it from myself until I chose to relieve it, or the Matrix was hiding it from me. It's
Jesus Christ.
This is why people don't like philosophy.
This is, I mean, I feel drool coming out of the side of my mouth.
One last break. When I come back, Matt Dillahunty talks Trump. I know, but you got to hear this. It really is interesting stuff as we get into humanism versus the current administration. We'll do it next. Hang on.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Hey, guys. It is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun, too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino-style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Last thing, and well, I guess we'll wrap it up. Moving into 2019. Are we looking at President Pence? I mean, have you been following all this insanity out there?
Hey, Matt, come over. We'll talk about Christmas. Last thing, do you think we're going to get President
Pence? This is a challenge because, you know, I've been active visting for 10 years. You've been at it much longer. I am glad to talk about my atheism. I'm glad to challenge religious claims.
Yeah.
But I am also more and more wanting to speak about humanism, the human condition. And that means we have to talk about things like the political system, culture, human rights. And this is immediately when somebody knee-jerks themselves into a tailspin and checks out and screams SJW and whatever invective they want to. And I'm like, look, if my lack of superstition or rejection of superstition does not inform a rooting of myself in the rational world, realizing that we only have each other to solve each other's problems. And if I'm not willing to do something actionable out of that, what good am I? I'm not saying everybody has to be an activist, but in my own life, I'm an atheist, but I really want to be about humanism. You can't be a humanist, especially a humanist activist, and not talk about the assault on science, reason, human rights that is the Trump administration, which is why, to the chagrin of many, I continue to bring it up on the show. Do you have people come after you and say, why the fuck won't you stop talking politics? And how do you respond?
There have always been people who objected to that. Now, I'll continue hosting the Atheist Experience just about as long as I can, and I'm always going to be, well, until somebody convinces me there's a God, I'll still be an atheist and I'll still talk about atheism. But in the last year or so, I've spent a lot more time focused on skepticism and humanism, partly because they're more important. Skepticism is what gets me to atheism, and humanism is what makes sure that I'm a decent human, absent a belief in a God. And because of that, we've talked about politics a lot on the show, and I don't do it as much on the Atheist Debates videos, but I'm happy to talk about it when I can. To the question of, are we going to get President Pence?
I mean, I just threw it out just to bait you.
Yeah, no. It's good bait, though, because I don't know enough about the law or the process. Because if it turns out that what happened was that Trump is actually an illegitimate president, then that would have to apply to Pence as well. Because Trump was the elected, but the ticket was Trump-Pence. Yeah. And so given how narrow the election was, I mean, he lost the popular vote, given what we're finding out about campaign finance violations that clearly, just at a face value, are obviously problems.
Yeah, conflict of interest with the Russian real estate.
The guy's a criminal, and now it's just we're probably not indicting him yet because he's the president. So this is already far greater than Watergate, and Nixon resigned. Somebody the other day said that if Fox News had been around, Nixon would not have resigned and would not have been impeached. And I think that may be relatively accurate.
Yeah.
But I wonder how, like, if Trump resigned tomorrow in the face of impeachment, Pence becomes president. So, yes, in that case, we would definitely get Pence as a president. Pence would almost certainly pardon him. Pence would almost certainly pardon him because Pence would care about protecting the office of the president, which is something Trump doesn't. You know, when I grew up, I had no idea who my folks voted for until Reagan, you know. So I don't know if they voted for Carter or not, because Carter here is a Democrat who's a Christian. My folks were probably largely single-issue voters from 1980 onward, and that was all about abortion. But I don't know how they voted in 76 or 72, and et cetera. But if Pence pardons him, then the question becomes, what becomes of Pence? Because if Trump's an illegitimate president, then that may mean also that Pence is. Now, we have plenty of potential constitutional crises.
So you think Pence would pardon him just the way Ford pardoned Nixon?
I would pardon him. Don't be wrong. As a person, I'm happy to see the guy go to prison. I'm happy to get him removed from office and everything else. But I value the office of the president enough and the notion of scandal that I would probably pardon him in the same way that Ford pardoned Nixon. Because I think he's done so much damage to the office already that we would need like an extra step of rehabilitation. I don't like Bush at all. Either one of them.
Okay.
But the first one was a great public servant. He had terrible politics and everything, but he was clearly a great public servant. He was somewhat self-effacing. He was, you know, CIA director and all these other things. He did a lot. He recently died, and so that's what reminds me. But I don't want to whitewash his thing either, because he also had some very terrible ideas. He was not at all a friend of the LGBTQ community. He may or may not have said some things about atheists or anything else. But at the end of the day, there's still the normal politics going on there. And Trump, I think, got elected in part because people knew that it wouldn't be normal. It's like, let's go in there and shake it up and let's drain the swamp, except that he's flooded the swamp. Find anybody else who've had this many people found guilty, going to prison, ever in the history of any administration.
It's an interesting thing that you say. I mean, I understand what you're saying. I mean, to stop the bleeding from a leadership level and the essentially highest, the point position of the United States of America. You say the damage is done, just get him out of Dodge.
Yes, I want him to disappear.
Okay.
And so I would have conditions for pardoning Trump because I don't think he would meet them, which means I probably wouldn't.
Well, hubris alone dictates he'd probably fight you to the end.
But. Yeah. Condition for my pardon would have been essentially that you go the fuck away and nobody ever hears from you again.
Go the fuck away. Yeah. Okay, we got it.
And I don't think he would actually meet that. So in reality, I probably would not end up pardoning. I know there would be a lot of pressure to do it.
So you're thinking big picture, let's remove him and let's stop talking about him as much.
Yes.
And focus on chapter 2.0 or whatever, 4.
Well, so I served in the military for 8.5 years. And so I have a different perspective on the military than some people do. And I will occasionally get in arguments with people on Facebook who are like, oh, anybody who's in the military is just, you know, awful. And I'm like, hang on, these are people who voluntarily give up their rights and serve. And they shouldn't take the hit just because the administration that they are sworn to follow or they will go to Leavenworth does something that you don't like. I agree. We had no business in Vietnam. But that doesn't mean that, and yes, there were some people in the U.S. military who did horrific things in Vietnam, which would be war crimes and should have been viewed as illegal orders that they didn't have to follow or things that they did on their own, running around killing kids. But that doesn't mean that everybody who comes back from Vietnam should be labeled a baby killer or disparaged. We fought that fight. The way we treated Vietnam vets was horrific and inexcusable, and we've since moved forward from that. The U.S. military has done all kinds of actions that people are going to disagree with for different reasons, some of which are obviously going to be wrong. It's undeniable that despite the Go America, there are occasions where we have almost certainly been the bad guy. The thing is, the world's not simple, and sometimes, you know, I don't want to do the collateral damage or break a few eggs. I'm saying that a decision has to be made, and I can respect that a person sincerely made the best decision they could with the information they had and turned out to be wrong. None of that is true of Trump. This is the least qualified, least knowledgeable, least educated, least diplomatic, least human president we've ever had. He does not care about the truth. He cares about his own pocketbook and his own ego and all the applause. He lies. And the thing is, people are like, well, every politician lies. Yes, they do. Every human being lies. I had this argument with a mutual friend of ours at one point who said he didn't lie. And I'm like, okay, well, that's a lie. but everybody lies because not all lies are necessarily bad. Some of them are the way you do diplomacy. Some of them are lies by omission. Some people don't want the unvarnished truth launched at them. Your God is a monster if he exists. That can be useful, but I'm more frustrated by the people who are like, well, you know, we can all just believe different things and it's not a big deal. But in Trump, we have somebody who doesn't care about the truth. This is how you get accusations of fake news left and right. Fox News has more viewers than CNN and MSNBC combined. It's the most watched news network, period. And if their news has a particular pro-Trump spin or does not actually work to accurately represent the truth, then that's what the majority of people are going to get. And the truth is, you know, I have family members. I'm sure they only watch Fox News. And I want to find a way to convince them that they don't have a reliable source. Because the problem isn't that they're evil or that they have bad goals. It's that they've been misled about many things. They've been misled about homosexuality and abortion and countless other things by religious doctrines. They've been misled about what should be a good source by religious doctrines in many cases, and they've just fallen for a different source. I don't know what the answer is. I just know that being quiet about it probably isn't going to help. And so that's why, you know, I don't get too many complaints about stop being so political. What we did get was a lot of, you guys are way too gay for us. When we talk about same-sex marriage and stuff, he's like, I used to like your show, but now it's all about social justice issues and how gay everybody is. And I was like, yeah, isn't it awesome? Hey, Matt, you're just an SJW cuck. Well, not a cuck, but SJW, sure. I am a somewhat of a warrior for social justice. You can toss it around like a pejorative like you did for liberal or whatever else. But that doesn't mean that I don't think there's plenty of people who also identify as SJWs who are just, you know, hyperbolic, reactionary, overly sensitive people. But that's true on both sides.
You know, you'll also find people who are actual social justice or SJWs or whatever, and they'll look at you and they think that you're far too...
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so you're not going to please everybody.
I have people on the right say I'm way out on the left. People on the left say I'm way out on the right. People in the center, I don't think they know what to do with me.
After a while, I just think some people just want to bitch and moan. So, and, you know, it's easy to throw stones. I mean, an honest criticism, if someone says, you know, you are wrong about this.
Yes.
I buy that. If someone comes out to me and says, you are a shill for feminists, feminist X, and they define feminist by the most extreme example of someone who embraces...
You're a man-hating...
Yeah. And SJW, cuck, whatever, you know, those types of things, the ad hominems, I just think I've just now removed yourself from the equation of, or removed yourself from any sort of reasonable conversation.
Yeah.
You're not here to discuss ideas.
I mentioned this yesterday when we were talking about Steve McRae because I blocked him on Twitter.
You really did block him?
I blocked him on Twitter and on Facebook, but for two different reasons. And actually, for two independent reasons that tie to one. And one of them is I don't have any interest in having lengthy discussions and conversations on Twitter. I think it's an awful format to do it. And so if it's very clear that it's just going to keep going around and around or back and forth and it's no longer a productive use of my time, and yet someone continues to tag me for days so that every time I log in, here's a flood of new things, I will get to a point where for my own sanity, I will block them because this has nothing to do with them. It has to do with the fact that when I see those kinds of conversations, I'm driven to engage, and it becomes a waste of time for me, and a waste of time that I almost can't avoid unless I do the block. Now, I don't block people just because they disagree with me. This is just about managing my time. And on Facebook, it was also about managing my time, but it was because I went over to his page, and he had this post that was, I'll paraphrase, I have lots of conversations with people, and a lot of them disagree. Here are some of the occupations of the people who disagree with me. Disc jockey, Walmart worker. Here are some of the occupations of the people who agree with me.
PhD.
Biochemist, blah, blah, blah. And then at the bottom it was, I'm not making an argument from authority. Yes, you are. If I posted that, I'd have been raked over the coals. How dare you? Plus, it's even worse because the people that he posted who agree with him, a biochemist has no expertise in epistemology.
Yeah.
Oh, you're saying this is a highly educated person with a PhD. Doesn't mean they can't be wrong.
It's like Dr. Steve Meyer, who's writing a book about molecular biology, and he has no idea.
Yeah. I can point you to plenty of PhDs who will disagree with you. But the issue was very much what's wrong with being a DJ? And by the way, I can point you to DJs who would disagree and be able to argue you under the table.
By the way, I'm not trying to discount someone who has a doctorate in a field, like one of the people I admire the most, Dr. Donald Prothero. What's interesting about people like Prothero is that he doesn't care if you use, call me Donald. He's authored like 30 books. He's a renowned paleontologist, geologist. He knows his stuff. He's a legend in his fields. And he didn't even put doctor on his books, which is amazing to me. If I find a PhD, I'd be plastering that shit all over the place.
But the second someone gives me an honorable PhD, that shit is on everything.
Dr.
Matt.
Well, I try to be optimistic, not blindly optimistic about the future, but I do hope that we see some kind of a course correction.
Yeah.
And I think, it's if it happens, it's going to happen with humanists fully engaged, and that means engaged culturally against the theocrats and politically. Sometimes there's overlap there.
Well, just given what's happened in the last couple of weeks regarding Trump, with Cohen being sentenced and Manafort coming up and Michael Flynn and all this other stuff, what do you think is most likely to happen, let's say, in the next 6 months?
What do I think is going to happen? I don't know. I'm so stunned by, I never thought we'd get this far. I do think there will be not a removal, but an impeachment or an impeachment process put into place. I theorize that he won't finish the term, that he will likely be removed in some way. I don't know that I predicted he would quit before he won, like before he actually took office, after he'd won. I thought there's no freaking way this guy's going to do 4 years. He's going to make up an excuse about the people who've ruined his life and come after him in the unfair media, and he's going to stomp off into the distance and go back and do his own thing. That was a prediction that has turned is completely wrong. Like, it has not remotely happened.
If all you have to do, though, is lie and tweet, he was doing that before.
He just doubles and triples and quadruples down. So, he's not leaving. So I think, there will be an impeachment, and I don't think he'll finish the 4 years. 2020 comes around. I have no idea. I don't want Hillary to run.
I don't either. And I voted for her, and I like her. And if she does run, unless there's another candidate in the primary, like I voted for Bernie in the primary.
You got Scott Beto O'Rourke down there in Texas. I kind of like the guy.
I like him. I like I said, I voted for Bernie in the primary, and I voted for Hillary in the general because that was the right thing to do. And it was funny to me because of the two, we had the least qualified versus potentially one of the most qualified, Secretary of State, former senator, former first lady. And, there was all this, lock her up, Benghazi, everything. Hey, you don't want to elect Hillary or we'll spend her entire term dealing with lawsuits and her criminal activities, when six different investigations bore out nothing. And yet here we are a couple of years into Trump's, and how many indictments have there been? How many guilty guilty pleas? And hey, I'm gonna agree to work with you guys. And I don't know enough about what the Mueller investigation knows and what it'll show to really conclude much. There's a part of me that wants to say he'll never resign or quit, unless it's like for health reasons, because I think his ego is too big to take that hit. On the other hand, if the right actually came after him and there was talk of impeachment, maybe he would.
What's it going to take? Know. Like all the people who are anonymously sort of trying to subvert the people taking the the documents off the Oval Office desk and submitting anonymous op-eds to the New York Times and whatnot. I find myself screaming at these news reports going, for God's sake, show a backbone, come out, get out in front of it, use your first and last name, show your face. Even the whistleblower, I think whistleblower laws would help to help public opinion, cultural support would keep you likely out of prison long term.
Whistleblower laws protect you from getting fired for coming out. It's not going to keep you from going.
Isn't it a public safety issue?
It may be that you can work a deal that way, but the whistleblower laws themselves, based on my understanding, are there to keep you from getting fired. They're not necessarily keep you from going to jail if you were complicit in a crime.
I see.
But I know that from an episode of The West Wing, so I could be wrong.
Well, I was thinking to myself, if there is a legitimate threat to, I mean, if you've got a loose cannon, somebody who is coming in and doing untoward illegal things and has access to, all the kind of power that most people never even dream of, it becomes then a public safety issue. So I don't know. I just wish they'd own it when they come forward and just, if the Republicans.
This is the argument, though, for not being able to indict a sitting president. So we ostensibly, nobody's above the law. We should be in a society where nobody's above the law, and we have a criminal sitting in the highest seat of the land, as far as we can tell. But there's a risk to indicting somebody that has the nuclear football. And so what would need to happen, I think, is that we're going to have to invoke the 25th Amendment and remove him from office temporarily in order to indict him. It could be unfit in the sense of a conflict that you're not above the law, so we have to indict you, but we can't indict you and try you while you still have access to all the nuclear codes and all this other stuff and are trying to run this. So what it may be is that we invoke the 25th, remove him from office, Pence takes over as president, and then all this process takes place about, indictments. And that's why I think he'll either resign or be forced to resign, and then Pence takes over and then pardons him, and then the rest of the term will be dealt with. Why should President Pence be there when he was just as illegitimate as Trump, who's on that same ticket?
I meant for this question to be kind of a postscript.
Yeah, and turned into a whole
separate thing. It's like we could do a whole show on it. So,
and neither one of us, by the way, know a damn thing about. we're in your boat.
We've been
assessing information. Yeah.
We're most people. Yeah,
I'm probably going to be wrong about a great deal of things that I'm guessing.
Ultimately, I'd welcome knowledge correction, whether it's the whistleblower laws in place and all that stuff. Whatever somebody knows, let us know. But I think at the end of the day, I do take encouragement by knowing that people, there are many. I mean, the cynics out there, I think, have surrendered to old people suck. It's all bad. You lost me at all.
Old people suck. Millennials suck. Boomers suck.
I refuse to surrender. Not blind optimism, but I do have optimism that there are good people out there who are working diligently and feverishly to try to restore good, to try to see good win the day, and we should all be part of that. And so, I don't think it's trying to look through rose-colored glasses to acknowledge that good people exist, and we may yet be able to turn the tide.
So let me ask you this, to get it back to the topic that we're supposed to start with. What do you want for Christmas?
I'm the worst guy to shop for. My wife will tell me, because if I want it, I'll just kind of go get it. And it's usually audio and video gear, so she has no idea what to buy. She's like, you want a mixer? You know, what kind of mixer? And, you know, the minute we get in, I might as well go buy it. I'll just go get it, honey. I'm good. Honestly, for me, it's become like, I read an article years ago that said that the people who accumulate experiences are happier than the people who spend all their time accumulating stuff. Yeah. No, I've got my toy. I got stuff, you know. I'm typical. I've got my little toys and accoutrements. But I have been more about, and this sounds so cliche, and you're going to laugh at me, but honestly, being able to be in my home, which is a religion-free, conflict-free, safe pod with me and Natalie and the kids, where we get to do Christmas together on our terms, and we get to watch the grandkid open his gifts, and we get to just kind of hang out and take phone photographs, and we got Bing Crosby in the background, and you know, we got homemade food. I'm just saying. I mean, that to me, does that mean I'm getting older? Probably.
Yeah. Well, you and I are in similar boats because I have a lot of stuff. I have too much stuff, actually, for somebody in my current living situation, but I have a number of things I collect. I have a number of musical instruments. I have a massive collection of magic stuff. I'm constantly looking for that stuff. I have my video games and my big TV and, you know, all that stuff. And I've got my truck. And I don't think about Christmas in terms of things anymore. I am incredibly disappointed that I may not be able to do as much for other people as I have in the past. You know, when financial situations change, you get that. What I want for Christmas, some sort of filing from the Mueller investigation that brings clarity. It doesn't have to be, we're done and here's everything. But I would like for everybody to wake up on Christmas morning with, in a shocking turn of events today, Robert Mueller filed this paperwork in court, and here are the salient details. And instead of referring to him as individual one, it actually says Donald J. Trump, you know, with a little bit more details, because the whole Russian thing is a mess. And I have never, ever been convinced that Donald Trump knowingly, actively colluded with Russia to win the election. Because I don't think he's smart enough to do it and get away with it. I don't think his ego is going to let him, when he runs around saying, no collusion, no collusion. I believe that he's actually being honest in the sense that he didn't collude. Whether or not other people colluded on his behalf, where there are entanglements, those are big deals. And I don't know what
I'd take that gift. Maybe we could make it a shared gift. You just, you know, however you celebrate, though, I hope it's a good year for you. I hope you continue to do what you do. I hope Atheist Debates and all that with the Atheist Experience, it will continue, right?
I'm going to do that'll keep going.
I mean, I know you're doing a lot more magic these days, but...
Well, and I'm going to be making some changes in 2019 because I'm no longer working with Pangburn. He's gone bankrupt and dealing with issues, and so I'll be booking my own events, which... and I'm going to be booking both the magic show. I'm doing the Magic and Skepticism on a freethoughtcruise.com or .org or whatever. I'm going to keep producing videos, but I'm also working on a couple new podcasts. One where I get a theistic person to sit down with me for 30 minutes on one very narrow topic.
You're not going to keep it you at 30 minutes?
It's not going to be, does God exist? It's going to be the first one. There's a Sikh who wants to explain to me how he reconciles his religion with science. That's it. That's the whole topic. 30 minutes. Mostly let him go at it and then ask some difficult questions.
I'll be watching that 30-minute clock. It's
a way to try to train myself to be more succinct. We're also going to be doing like a mailbag show with the Atheist Experience where we offer clarifications and corrections based on your feedback. But my favorite thing that I'm going to do this year for Christmas, and not to slight you, because if I wasn't doing this other thing, this would have been my favorite thing, to come out and hang out with you guys. Tomorrow I get to see my grandmother, and it's my last remaining grandparent. She's 91. She just was in the hospital with pneumonia a week or so ago. She's out and doing fine, and we're going to sit around and, you know, play some cards and chat for a while, and then I'll move on with the rest of my trip.
Matt Dillahunty, host of Atheist Debates. He's one of the hosts of the Atheist Experience. And is your website going? And what's the best way to find you, YouTube or...
Oh, just Google my name. MattDillahunty.com's up, but it's not being used for much right now. You'll find me.
All right. Matt Dillahunty, thanks again, brother.
Thank you.
Follow The Thinking Atheist on Facebook and Twitter.
Watch dozens of original videos on the Thinking Atheist YouTube channel. And visit our website for resources, links, contact information, the editor's blog, and more. TheThinkingAtheist.com.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woo-hooer, a hand clapper, a high-fiver? I kind of like the high-five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino-style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses, so don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+.